Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
Back in the spring of 2000, I was sitting at home in Dublin when the phone rang. A familiar voice asked, "Will you come back?" I was warned this might happen. I had left the touring life after 2.5 years just a few months earlier as the new millennium began. Living out of a suitcase in hotel rooms across the North American continent, from Savannah to Sacramento to Saskatoon, had lost its appeal. But it was Riverdance, the global phenomenon, a show that was hard to say no to. I was a stage manager, and not a dancer, musician, or performer of any kind. "Back to where?" I asked. "New York," came the reply. Suddenly, I was very interested indeed. I had toured with the smallest of the three touring companies, playing theatres, while the other shows played stadiums and arenas. They played the big cities. I had never been to Boston, LA, or Chicago. I had never been to New York, and now here, finally, was my chance. My work visa for the US was still current, while the stage manager who was supposed to take that show to Broadway had experienced delays getting her visa. I had to be in New York the next day, and I had to hit the ground running. Having called cues to the crew over a headset 8 times a week for 2 years, I did not anticipate any problems. I arrived on a Friday. A car took me from JFK to the Gershwin Theatre. There seemed to be hundreds of people milling around, each one more senior than me, and each one having strong opinions on how the show should run. The electric fizz of excitement was in the air. Broadway, baby! I realised when I arrived that there were new numbers in this show. This was a revitalised Riverdance. There was an amazing African choir called Amanzi, and Brian Kennedy had been added to the lineup. New songs had been written for them. Some of the choreography had changed, and the running order was in a constant state of flux from one rehearsal to the next. We had our first preview on Tuesday, and I was the person responsible for making sure that the lighting, sound and flying backdrop cues happened at exactly the right spot in the music. Maestro Bill Whelan had written really beautiful new music for these additions to the show, but I don't think anybody there knew that I couldn't read music. I had learned all of the cues by counting rounds of the fiddle reel or by visual cues, but now that everything was changing, I was quite lost. I didn't see daylight for about 10 days. I was desperately trying to keep up with the daily notes. "The changes between numbers must happen faster," somebody said. "A quick bow at the end of that number and the choir must be in place within 7 seconds," said somebody else. "Air on the side of air," I was told, resulting in my almost killing the lead dancer with the flying backdrop when he exited the stage after his quick bow. Thankfully, he was not injured and I was not sued or sent home, but my God, the pressure. My station was at the very back of the auditorium, beside the sound booth. There were two men in the sound booth, one of whom I knew from touring days, and another guy who I didn't know at all. I wondered what his role was. He wore a red baseball cap back then, when there was nothing weird or sinister about such headwear. He also had grey-green sparkly eyes. On the second Sunday after the matinee, I think the producers realised that cast and crew were in a state of exhaustion, and it was announced that we were all off until Tuesday morning when rehearsals would resume. And what did an exhausted cast and crew of hundreds do on their first evening off in 10 days? Well, most of us went to the nearest pub, B.B. Doyle's, on West 51st Street. Somebody introduced me to Red Baseball Cap. His name was Richard, and he worked for Bill Whelan in his studio in Connemara. Richard wasn't really there to work. Bill just realised that every single person who had worked on the new Riverdance Broadway album was going to be in New York, so he invited Richard too. It turned out that Richard had never been to New York either. Somebody else suggested that Richard and I should go sightseeing together the next day. We started talking that night in the bar, and 25 years later, the conversation is ongoing. Thank God for the delayed visa and the generosity of Bill Whelan. So thank you for the music, Riverdance, and the husband.
When you've lived abroad for as long as I have, you tend to find echoes of Ireland in the most unusual of places. That was the case last summer when I spent a short holiday in the Dakotas, two huge, sparsely populated Western American states. Even today, they're hard to get to, and are often among the last of the 50 US states visited by enthusiastic travellers seeking to see all of America. In the late 19th century, they were remote frontier societies that attracted the ambitious and the adventurous. Theodore Roosevelt, who had a privileged upbringing in New York, fled to the badlands of North Dakota in the 1880s to seek solace on the American frontier following the death on the same day of his wife and his mother. When I found myself in the North Dakotan town of Medora, I stayed at the Rough Riders Hotel, where the memory of Roosevelt's two-year spell in the area is richly celebrated. The hotel lobby boasts an extensive library of books related to Roosevelt and his many interests. I opened a volume of his collected works devoted to literary criticism, and to my amazement hit upon an intriguing essay on Irish sagas published by Roosevelt in January 1907 while he was President of the United States. It's hard to imagine any serving US president or Irish Taoiseach of recent vintage having the time or the inclination to undertake such an ambitious scholarly venture. Roosevelt did not have any ancestral connection with Ireland, and indeed had made his career as a reformer pushing back against Irish-American dominance of New York politics. In his 1907 essay, Roosevelt lauded early Irish poetry, which he thought had some unique beauties that were not to be found elsewhere. He drew a politician's conclusion that the Anglo-Norman invasion had had ruinous effects on the growth of national life in Ireland, a sentiment with which I am sure many of us would readily concur. While he was busy delving into Ireland's antique literature, Roosevelt hosted a distinguished Irish visitor, Douglas Hyde, later Ireland's first president, who was on a seven-month tour of America raising money for the Gaelic League. He travelled to Washington in the winter of 1906 and met with the president at the White House. During a convivial conversation over a simple lunch, washed down with a cup of tea and a glass of sherry, Roosevelt revealed that he had been raised by Irish nursemaids from whom he had first heard the legendary names of Cuchulainn and Fionn MacCool. Hyde was impressed by his host's knowledge of Irish and Norse mythology. The president told Hyde that he planned to write to American universities, urging them to appoint Irish language professors so as to capture all that was good in Irish life and make it part of America. Hyde was not the only Irish writer to encounter President Roosevelt during his 7 years in high office. During his first visit to America in 1903, W.B. Yeats was invited to the White House to meet the president. The president was already an admirer of the Irish literary revival. Yeats, who would write approvingly of Constance Markievicz when as a young woman she rode to harriers, was warned in Washington not to accept an invitation to go horse riding with the president, who was a notoriously vigorous horseman. While he was president, Roosevelt had the habit of inviting ambassadors to ride with him at pace through Washington's Rock Creek Park, which must have been a bracing experience. Riding the range in the Dakotas, as Roosevelt had done for 2 years, would have been a far cry from Yeats's image of the Galway races where delight makes all of the one mind, the riders upon the galloping horses, the crowd that closes in behind. The fact that a famously active American president was willing to make time to meet the two visiting Irish writers highlights the fact that Irish literature was causing quite a stir in those early years of the 20th century. After he left the presidency, Roosevelt retained an attachment to Irish writing, especially to Lady Gregory, whose work he greatly admired. He sided with the Abbey Theatre against its Irish-American critics of the Playboy of the Western World when the Abbey toured the play in America in 1911. Roosevelt credited the Abbey with having brought about a revival of the ancient Irish spirit, which is precisely how Yeats and Lady Gregory would have seen it. In Roosevelt's view, the Abbey had succeeded because its plays spring from the soil and evoke the heart of the Irish people. In today's Washington, Roosevelt, who inspired the original teddy bear, is remembered chiefly for his involvement in a mock race against effigies of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and Abraham Lincoln that takes place every time the city's baseball team plays a home game. It is a contest in which, for some reason, the Roosevelt effigy is always an also-ran. Now, that would never happen to Cucullin or Finn McCool, or to the hard-riding country gentleman of Yeats's imagination.
As I rode out through Galway town to seek for recreation on the 17th of August, me mind being elevated, there were multitudes assembled with their tickets.
Anish Chaktanarik, Begin Log Dol Conshina, is Thresh Felebrija or Doig Me Muyol. Spring, it's on the way. No sooner had we marked the winter solstice when the wags, myself among them, we're hashtagging grand stretch all over social media. And yes, now it's March. There's no doubt the stretch is perceptible. Here in the West, we watch the sky eke out the last of the light, even though it's often overcome by squally clouds on the horizon. But something else happens at this time of the year. The light changes. What is it about the light in this country that it affects us so much? Observe clouds skimming the sunset, the splintered light through the webbed branches of a lime tree, the luminous splashback from a wind-whipped sea. See how it becomes a refracted glow from golden sand, or how on the leaves of Lady's Mantle, raindrops become bowls of silvered light. The women of my family have a connective relationship with light. Frosty starlight moves us. Texts flit from phone to phone. Have you seen the moon tonight? Then there is the mantra. Have you noticed? The light has changed. How do you explain an instinctive, abstract, emotional reaction to a law of physics? A lumen is a SI unit of measurement for how the human eye perceives the power of light, allowing for the uniquely human sensitivity to differing light wavelengths. How many lumens in the phrase, "I love this early summer light"? For it's true. Early May light is soft and voluptuous, caressing white thorn and newly sprouted foliage. Skies in June have a gentility to their blueness, not like the brash azures of July and August. In those months, the depths of nature's colours are revealed. In high summer, as the setting sun rests millimetres above the horizon, plants pull in saturating light. Johnson's blue geraniums and red pelargoniums glow like stained glass masterpieces from Harry Clark. Here, in Northwest Europe, by late August, it's time to ask that question, is it me or has the light changed? Already, a sapphire coldness has crept into the blue intensity, heralding autumn. If we're lucky, the unclouded colour deepens, clarified and filtered by frosty October air. In such generous weather, breathing, although an involuntary act, is acknowledged. Time to stand still, to take in the crisp air, while the turning trees paint their own magic onto the landscape. Light sensitivity. It affects us daily. The oncoming interrogation of traffic on a wintry night, reflecting against sleeting rain on the windscreen. The malfunctioning, flashing strobe in the Chinese takeaway.
The slightly blurred projection in a cinema. Artificial light has a lot to answer for. Except at Christmas. One of the delights of living in the country is driving through darkened limestone hills and happening upon a lit-up home where welcoming fairy lights gild barren trees. Impossible not to smile in the car as I whiz from one island of light to another. In January, when getting out of bed is too much to ask of a body, there was barely enough room to light or inflame a migraine. Those were the dark days. The engulfing days of carbohydrate snacking and feeling the blues. But then the pagan and Irish calendar moves on. With a blessing from Bridget, just before Candlemas, the light changes. As for the stretch, my grandmother had a saying about that. St. Bridget is reported to have said that after her feast day, the days would lengthen by a cock step on the dung heap every second day. St. Patrick said, after my feast day, a cockerel's step every day. That's the patriarchy for you. Still though, grand stretch.
The year was 1989. I had accrued enough time at my German university to qualify for a year's work as an assistant teacher abroad. I felt I needed to get away from Germany, for a while at least, and see what working as a teacher was like. I longed to leave Germany. I was bored by the place. I wanted to immerse myself in Irish culture. Ever since I had fallen in love with Ireland when I visited as a Boy Scout, I had surrounded myself with things Irish. I immersed myself in Irish literature and history and knew the songs from the Dubliners off by heart. I wanted to breathe in the culture on a daily basis, so I applied for a job within the German-Irish Teachers Exchange Service. I moved to Greystones, County Wicklow, ironically leaving Germany just ahead of the winter of what would turn out to be one of the most exciting times in its modern history, the fall of the Berlin Wall. In Ireland, I availed of the year-long hospitality of Brendan, a friend I had known from my days as a Boy Scout. One day in mid-October, I was on my way to Dublin. I had missed the number 84 bus from Greystones to Bray and decided to walk along the main road and try to hitch a lift to Bray, or maybe even further into the Big Smoke. At that time, Dublin deserved the title All Right. The ban for smokeless coal only came in January 1990. The day was cold and windy, and as I was walking up the hill from Greystones towards Bray, at a location aptly known as the Wind Gates, I kept sticking out my thumb whenever I heard a car approaching from behind me. Presently, a car slowed down beside me and then stopped. A big silver 5-series BMW, the latest model. The passenger door swung open and I heard a male voice asking, "Where are you going, young man?" "Dublin," I said, "but Bray would certainly do." "Jump in, young man. I'm going to Dublin myself. I'll take you there." I could not believe my luck and sat down in this very impressive machine. The driver, however, did not match his car. His age was difficult to gauge. He had white hair and a long white beard, and when he spoke, his voice was the deepest baritone voice I had ever heard. He listened as I talked and talked about home. I was happy to practice my English. With great pride did I tell him that I was playing the Bowron in an Irish folk band in my hometown and that we were playing all the classics. As we passed Bray and Shankill on the old coast road, I shut up and tried to be polite and ask him where he was going and what he was doing. I'm a musician too, he said, and I'm going into town to meet a few friends. There might be a session later on, and we have invited a few musicians from England to join in. I was most surprised that this, to me, elderly musician, took such a fancy car into Dublin to meet friends for a session. In my world, comprising student bands busking in the streets and me banging the bar on in the local Irish pub, musicians were poor and did not drive silver BMWs. It became clear to me then that I must be sitting beside a musician unlike the ones I was used to. I looked sideways at him again, and I can safely say that I have hardly ever been as embarrassed in my life as in that particular moment when I realized that my chauffeur was none other than the great Ronnie Drew. Did I not possess all the records made by the Dubliners back home? Didn't that voice sound so familiar? And wasn't this the era when the Dubliners and their friends from England, a.k.a. Shane McGowan and the Pogues, were recording the most amazing records, blending traditional Irish music with contemporary pogo music? I can assure you, the fabric of the seat in this BMW could not have been soft and fluffy enough to allow me to disappear in his creases. Oh my God, you're Ronnie Drew, I stuttered. I am so sorry. How could I not have recognized you? He just turned sideways and laughed out loud. And Ronnie Drew's resounding voice embarking into a heartfelt laughter was something I will never forget for the rest of my life. I'm glad it took you a while, because you probably would not have told me all these details of a German student's life otherwise, or would you? His laughter was akin to a roar, and we ended up having the most enjoyable trip into town, in which he told me about the Dubliners' lives, about the great Luke Kelly, and that exciting new poet from England, Shane McGowan, who was going to revolutionize the Irish folk music scene, Ronnie was convinced. Read the lyrics to Summer in Siam and A Rainy Night in Soho, and you know he's a genius, Ronnie recommended. He dropped me near the canal in Dublin, and I walked back the short distance towards Raglan Road and immortalized this day and my unforgettable encounter with Ronnie Drew by recollecting Luke Kelly's rendition of this most romantic song, full of heartbreak and unrequited love. I was yet to hear Summer in Siam and A Rainy Night in Soho, but when these songs were released only a short few months afterwards, they have ranked among my favorite poems and songs ever since, on a par with Raglan Road. And all of these through the prism of that special lift to Dublin by Ronnie Drew in a silver Beamer in October 1989.
Well, it's summer in Siam, and the moon is full of rainbows. Well, it's summer in Siam, then we go through many changes.
Dublin is a city of hidden places and forgotten histories. But just now and again, if you keep your eyes open, you can get a sudden glimpse into unexpected nooks and crannies of the city's past. I got such a sideways glimpse recently, on an icy day in January, as I picked my careful way around the old walls of Trinity College, en route to a coffee shop on Dublin's Nassau Street to meet my sisters. I had stopped for a moment to steady myself, when my roving eye was caught by two nameplates, set high up and a little apart on the wall across the street. All streets in Dublin bear those familiar nameplates, showing the street name in Irish and English. But Nassau Street goes one better, for it displays three names on two separate nameplates near to the junction of Nassau Street and Grafton Street. One sign displays the English name Nassau Street and an unembellished Irish version of that name, Sroid Nassau. The other nameplate bears the same English name, accompanied by a non-related Irish name, Sroid Hubber Fordrick, or in English, Patrick's Well Street. I had to find out more about this unusual proliferation of nameplates. My researches soon revealed that the different Irish name for Nassau Street arose from the legend that St. Patrick, when he returned to Ireland in the 5th century, founded a holy spring along today's Nassau Street and used the waters there to baptise some of the earliest Irish converts. for St. Patrick was a prolific baptizer of the Irish. Legend has it that he baptized some 100,000 Irish to the religion of Christ during his long mission in the country. Patrick wrote of his baptisms in his letter of rebuke, the Epistola, to the violent chieftain Caroticus, who had been attacking his converts. His tender affection for the Irish still shines through those ancient words, written some 1,600 years ago. And yet I rejoice within myself. I have not worked for nothing. Thanks to God, you who are baptized believers have moved on from this world to paradise. You leap for joy like calves set free from chains. It may be hard to imagine such a scene in today's modern Nassau Street, but the power of the legend of St. Patrick's Well is undeniable. It has survived regime changes and name changes, and over the centuries, Dubliners continued to imbibe the waters of the well in the belief that they could obtain a cure for their ailments, especially if they did so on St. Patrick's Day. Over time, the custom grew for Dubliners to visit the well on St. Patrick's Day every year, to drink the waters, to beg for the saint's help, and perhaps to do a bit of celebrating as well. Generations came and went, and the site of the spring became known as St. Patrick's Well Lane. There was consternation when the well dried up in 1729, and Dean Swift commemorated the alarming event in a satirical poem where he attributed the catastrophe to the hard-drinking students of Trinity College, whom he darkly suspected of drinking the well dry. Happily, the waters of St. Patrick's Well were restored, and generations of Dubliners continued to make their pilgrimages there, reputedly giving rise over time to the tradition of honouring St. Patrick's Day, a tradition which today is one of the most widely observed days in the world. The legend of St. Patrick's Well even survived a name change in the mid-18th century when the street name was officially altered to honour William III of Orange, who had been known as the Count of Nassau before attaining kingship. It is perhaps hard to understand how the ancient Irish designation of the street survived throughout the centuries, but somehow it did, and somehow a solitary sign bearing the old Irish name still hangs in Nassau Street, acting as a silent reminder of that sliver of Dublin's history now lost in the mists of time. St. Patrick's Well still exists today within the confines of Trinity College. It is contained in a narrow vault that runs under Nassau Street, near to its junction with Dawson Street. The well is hard to locate and nowadays lies behind a dilapidated locked door. Centuries ago, its waters were about 13 metres deep, but they are just a little over 1 metre deep today. But the well is not dry, and remains an evocative place of living history, where once, according to the writings of St. Patrick, the newly baptised Irish may have leapt for joy like calves set free from chains.
I arise today through the strength of heaven, light of sun, radiance of moon, splendor of fire, speed of lightning, swiftness of wind, depth of the sea, stability of earth.
St. Patrick. Hum, clink, bam, boom, and we wake to the news. The dingle pipe and drum band have had their pre-dawn parade. Ah, here we go. Most of the government is on a jolly, gone foreign, bearing bowls of shamrock, flying the flag, pressing the flesh of the great, the good, or not so good. The local teens are on an off-license mission. The husband cooks up bacon and cabbage, veggie and non-veggie versions. And I wonder how to get the dog to wear shamrock boppers. The parade is the usual high dough of ladder joy, tots on shoulders, mockness, madness, batons twirling, samba beats, Latin dancing and hard shoe jigs. I bail into St. Patrick's Cathedral and light a candle before the man himself. Did this reluctant migrant have any idea? He lit fires on the hill of Tara and gave us Irish and our global family a full license to celebrate like we own all of God's green acre. Back in town, the pubs are blaring Cayley music. Tourists and locals are swinging out of each other, jigging, spinning and reeling like champion Irish dancers. Jesus, Paddy, we'll all pay for this tomorrow.
On this morning's programme, we heard Broadway Baby by Liz Nugent, Teddy's Irish Bards by Daniel Mulhall, Grand Stretch by Karen J. MacDonald, I'm a Musician, Meeting Ronnie Drew by Georg Grote, Shroud Hubber Fodrig by Anne Delaney, and St. Patrick, a poem by Rachel Hegarty. The music was extracts from Riverdance, all composed by Bill Whelan, the main theme, and before that, Amanzi, performed by the Amanzi Singers. The Galway Races by the Dubliners. Speed the Plough, a reel played by Blackie O'Connell on pipes, Siobhan Peoples on fiddle, and Cyril O'Donoghue on bouzouki. And along with Karen J. MacDonald's essay, that was recorded at a previous Sunday Miscellany Live at the Ennis Book Club Festival. Then Summer in Siam by the Pogues and The Deer's Cry by Sean Davey featuring Rita Connolly on vocals. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon and the producer is Sarah Binchy. And you can listen back to the programme on the RTE radio app or on all the usual podcast platforms. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.